Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by Proliance Energy. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. This month's speaker is C-SPAN founder Brian Lamb. Lamb was born in Lafayette, Indiana, and graduated from Purdue University. Lamb then joined the Navy and served at the White House during the Johnson administration and at the Pentagon during the Vietnam War. He's also worked as a freelance reporter, a Senate press secretary, and a White House staffer. In 1974, Lamb worked as a Washington bureau chief for Cablevision magazine. By 1977, Lamb had won the support of key cable industry executives for a channel that could deliver gavel-to-gavel coverage of the U.S. Congress. C-SPAN began broadcasting in 1979. Lamb talks about some of the problems that come up in covering events in Washington. He also compares some of the rather salty language at a recent congressional hearing to the style of President Lyndon Johnson many years ago.
Now I'm pleased to introduce our speaker. Instead of weeding through political commentary or wondering if that senator really said that, C-SPAN viewers see it all, straight from the House and Senate floors. Brian Lamb founded C-SPAN in 1979 to provide public access to the political process. He's been described as one of the most influential people in media, and his network has immensely changed the way government and politics are covered. C-SPAN has expanded over the years to now include three 24-hour television networks, radio broadcasts, and an online presence. In efforts to allow complete access, C-SPAN this year put its full archives on the web, allowing the public to view more than 160,000 hours of coverage spanning 23 years free. You do the math on that, by the way. Without a break, it would take you 18 years and 3 months to see everything that's on their website. An avid reader of newspapers and nonfiction, for 15 years, Brian Lamb hosted Book Notes, a show during which he conducted one-on-one interviews with authors, and he currently hosts a Sunday evening interview series called Q&A. We'll have our own version of Q&A following your presentation, Brian. In 2007, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. President George W. Bush bestowed the honor on Mr. Lamb for his dedication to a transparent political system. He also was recipient of the Fourth Estate Award, the National Press Club's highest honor for lifetime achievement in journalism. A native of Lafayette, Brian Lamb joined the Navy after graduating from Purdue University. His service included White House duty during the Johnson administration and a stint in the Pentagon Public Affairs Office. He later worked as a Senate Press Secretary. He has held on to his Hoosier roots, too, telling a Washington newspaper, more than anything, I'm a guy who grew up in a small town in Indiana. Well, we're glad to have him back in Indiana today. Would you please join me in welcoming Brian Lamb?
About 5 or 6 years ago, Larry O'Connor invited me to come to this group, which I did, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And about 8 months ago, he said, can you come back? And I must tell you, waiting 8 months to do this kind of thing is very difficult because, one, you don't know if you're going to be here, but you think about it for entirely too long. I have some so-called friends in the audience, and they're located in strategic locations out there, so if you start to throw things at me, they're ready to grab you. I want to start. We're going to see a lot of video. None of it's very long. Some of it is a little bit tedious to hear, and some of it is a bit grainy because when we put this together, you didn't know what it was going to look like when you project it on the big screen. So if you look up and say, ugh, that video stinks, it does, but it's the content. First, before we start, I want to show you how we're portrayed in some of today's media. You can see there's a list up there of some of the people you're going to see in the next few minutes. So let's just let John Stewart explain to you what C-SPAN is all about.
C-SPAN, for those of you with sex lives, is 24-hour coverage of your government in all its visual splendor. I've actually supped my hotel minibar all the way down to the Freon thanks to 72 hours of this.
Mrs. Boxer, Mr. Bro, Mr. Brownback, Mr. Bunny, Mr. Burns, Mr. Bird.
That's a show called Roll Call Vote. It's one of C-SPAN's better shows. It's kind of the car chase of the democratic process. But C-SPAN also has real programs with beginnings, endings, and vast chasms of middle. Take book notes. Talking about books on TV sounds a little boring to you. Wait until you hear the kind of books they're talking about.
On October 27th, Charles Slack on the 1839 discovery of rubber vulcanization in Noble Obsession.
Rubber vulcanization? Whoa! Rubber vulcanization? Slow it down, baby. I'm still reading my collection of short stories about turpentine. You've also got Washington Journal, a show where journalists and a moderator straighten papers to classical music. All right, I think we get the point. Hey, you know what would make that a more interesting show? Slowly filling the room with water. Not yet. Not yet thrilled? Well, I learned there's even a C-SPAN 2 and a C-SPAN 3, which I thought, great, that's probably for the edgier stuff. The backroom deals, the secret conspiracies, maybe even some of that sex we're always reading about. But actually, it's just more of this.
Mr. Hagel.
After that rant a couple years ago, friends of mine have since referred to C-SPAN as the Aquarium Channel, as they've done. When you're associated with an organization like ours, you never know what you're going to get on a day-to-day basis. And this morning was no different than any other day. I woke up after we covered yesterday's Lloyd Blankfein hearing and others from Goldman Sachs for 11 hours. Started at 10:01. It finished last night close to 9 o'clock. And we had every minute of it on there. I woke up to this in today's Atlantic magazine blog. It's safe to say, first of all, the headline says, Carl Levin saves C-SPAN by saying, and I will not pronounce it, S-H-I-T-T-Y, a dozen times on camera. Here's how they feel about us. It's safe to say C-SPAN isn't the most stimulating TV. It's static camera work, unimaginative graphics department, and impenetrably wonky subject matter challenge most any viewer's patience. But today, Senator Levin gave the network a shot in the arm. His subcommittee is examining Goldman Sachs' role in the financial crisis, and he unearthed a company email describing a bleep deal. That's when it all hit the fan. And then there's a similar interview I did with Richard Lugar a number of years ago. This was back in 1992, I believe. You can see the date when it was recorded up in the corner. Let's run this. And this is about his days at Oxford, but he also has a little...
A lot of hours looking at what it's like to go to Oxford, what it's like to be a Rhodes Scholar. And in our studios, wearing a jacket that I hesitate to ask him how old it is, but you see there the Pembroke College emblem on his... jacket is Senator Richard Lugar, and he's also today he's worn his tie from that period. Is that tie that old? That tie looks like it might be a little bit newer than.
No, they were both bought in 1954.
They were. So
at the time I entered Oxford in September of 54.
What's it mean to have be an alumni of Oxford and a Rhodes Scholar?
I'm very appreciative for the opportunity. I think as all the scholars have told you, it was an opportunity for me to broaden my horizons enormously. This is one reason that I sought the scholarship. I had a sense that the world was a lot bigger than Indiana or Denison, where I went to undergraduate work. But I really didn't know the alternatives. for my career, for my life. I've been active always throughout high school and college as a reformer, trying to do things that I thought would make things better. And I was interested in the potential for politics because I thought saw that as the avenue for constructive change.
One of the reasons I want you to know about this is that any of you in this room that want to get on and research what we've had on over the last 23 years can do the same thing. I did this myself, and believe me, I am not very good at the computer and doing all this stuff, and it was really fun. And I didn't pick them for any particular reason, except in this case, of course, the Rhodes Scholarship paid off for him years later, the Trester Award. And here's another fellow I got to know who is originally from Kokomo. He's now a star on PBS, Tavis Smiley.
But you were on top at Kokomo High School, weren't you? I mean, you were the president of the student council?
Yeah, in high school, I was president of my class and president. I went to a school called McConaughey right outside of Kokomo, and I was president of my class and on the student council and voted most likely to succeed. And all of that was wonderful. And I talk fondly about that, some in this book, but I think more in one of my previous books called Hard Left. I talk about that experience growing up in Indiana, and the remarkable thing about it for me, I look now, for example, at all the race issues that we have in this country. Racism, I believe, is the most intractable, the most egregious, the most divisive issue in this country. I look back through my own experience as a kid, and I never really had any experience with racism. I went, and the remarkable thing is, growing up in the cornfields of north central Indiana, as you well know, wasn't a lot of black folk hanging around. So I was like, you know, there were, for example, 1,200 kids in my high school. Of the 1,200, only 26 were black. And keep in mind, there are 10 kids in my family, you know. So we made up the majority of black kids in the school. And yet every year, these white kids, every year voted me class president. These white kids voted me most likely to succeed. These white kids, you know, lifted me up as the guy who best represents us. And here I am, you know, black, they're white, and it never became an issue.
Kokomo, Indiana, only 45 minutes from Lafayette. And that's where our archive is located, in West Lafayette, Indiana. And the way it happened, back in the 80s, I was back at Purdue for an event, and I asked the head of the Department of Political Science if he knew some college professors I could meet with and suggest some ideas. And we met with six of them over in the Union, and I just tossed out the idea that we were anxious to do an archive, and if anybody here was interested, we'd like to work together. One person in the group, Robert Browning, who's currently full-time with us, he still teaches a course up at Purdue, said he was interested, went to the department head, they got together, we furnished a lot of the money, and today it's located up there, we have 10 employees, and he invented this thing from start to finish, and has just gone through the digitization process, which means that it's all available for anyone free in this country, thanks to our cable industry that has underwritten all this. It's terrific if you're interested. Obviously, you're not. It doesn't matter. But we have people in the media, in politics, in the general public accessing this kind of thing all day long and particularly interested in getting kids in the classroom to use it. This next clip may be my favorite. It's only an audio clip. Some of you in this room will remember my former congressman from Lafayette, Indiana, Charlie Halleck. He was majority leader for a while. He was minority leader for a while. He served for 34 years in the House. This is the kind of thing that you'll never hear again. This was a telephone interview, not an interview, telephone conversation from the Oval Office with Lyndon Johnson. They released some 10,000 of these conversations, and we run all of them on our radio station, and they're available online. This was in October of 1964. Johnson was running again. He hadn't run. He unfortunately took over from Jack Kennedy after he was assassinated. But they're having this conversation. Listen very carefully. It's a little staticky, but you'll never hear anybody talk to a president like good old Charlie Halleck in this conversation.
Now, wait a minute, Mr. President. I appreciate your call, and I don't want to detain you because you're a damn sight more important than I. But let me just tell you this, my friend. We get your civil rights bill passed, and you can't do it without us. Understand? You sign that up July 4th. Give us the next 2 weeks off in the House. I'm not talking about the Senate. For our convention. We got 17 guys on that resolutions committee. You can't pass anything that next week. I'll guarantee you can't.
Well, Charlie, why don't you let us go on? Why don't you let us take these things up? Let the majority decide it.
Well, I'll let you... Now, goddammit, Mr. President, I'll do a few of those things. But you ain't going to curry any favor with me. I might as well be blunt about it. Making us stay here when we got 20, 30 guys from the house wanting to go to our convention.
You oughtn't to hold up my poverty bill. That's a good bill. There's no reason why you ought to keep a majority from beating it. You can beat it. Go on, beat it. But you oughtn't to hold it up. You ought to give me a fair shake and give me a chance to vote on it. I've got it in my budget. I cut my budget $1 billion under last year.
Wait, let me talk to you in just a minute. You want the civil rights bill through. You want the tax bill through. And I helped you do it. And God damn it, did I help you in civil rights?
Yeah, you sure did. You helped Kennedy.
Kennedy didn't help you.
We're trying.
Now wait just a minute, my friend.
Then you helped yourself. Of course, you all want civil rights as much as we do. I believe it's a nonpartisan bill. I don't think it's a Johnson bill.
No, you're going to get all the political matters. We aren't going to get a goddamn...
No.
Tim McGinley is sitting right down here with his lovely wife, Jane, and we had the fortunate experience when I was a military aide in the Johnson White House. He was a White House fellow. And I know when he had those meetings with the president, he talked to him just like Charlie Halleck did there. That's how Tim got to run Purdue University for all those years. Here's Dan Quayle. And the reason I ran this one has nothing to do with his vice presidency or his time in the Senate or the House, but it's very local. And I know things have changed here, but for us old-timers, it's interesting to hear his perspective on a name, Gene Pulliam, his grandfather.
You write about Eugene Pulliam. Who was he?
Gene Pulliam was my grandfather. He was an independent publisher, a very intelligent, tough individual. He was a person that started out as a son of an itinerant Methodist minister in the plains of Kansas and worked his way up to being a very well-respected newspaper publisher and one of the people that made a real impact in the media and the newspaper business when he was around.
Did he start in Indianapolis?
He actually got his start in Franklin, Indiana, which is, you know Indiana quite well. It's just south of Indianapolis. That was his Lebanon, Indiana, Franklin, Indiana, I think were his first papers. At one time, he owned 50 newspapers, and he owned a number of radio stations.
Here are a couple more politicians. One of them, fortunately, still alive, Birch Bayh, age 82. Vance Hartke passed a couple years ago. Just as very short, just to show you that this kind of thing is in the archive.
The 25th Amendment was intended by its authors to provide a way in which there could be complete continuity in the utilization of presidential powers.
I look out here, and I look at you young people, and I think of something about what us older people think. And then I think again... And you're going to start thinking pretty soon. You're going to start thinking what you're going to do when you have parents who are as old as those of us who are up here in front of you today.
If I were teaching, I would point out to the kids or anybody that was interested that Birch Bayh was responsible for the 25th Amendment, which was presidential succession, and the 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age to 18. And then I would combine that with the fact that Gerry Ford would have never been president if it hadn't have been for Birch Bayh. In addition to that, Gerry Ford beat Charlie Halleck out as the minority leader in the House of Representatives. There's all kinds of possibilities with this stuff if you're trying to bring it to life for young people. The next one also I find to be very valuable, especially in light of what's going on in our country today. Now, this was 1994. Evan Bayh had been governor for a couple of years. Listen carefully to what he says, and we run the State of the State speeches every year of all the governors, but listen how he characterizes the world in 1994.
Nothing is more important or more vulnerable to change than the fiscal security of our state. In recent years, both national recession and skyrocketing health costs have posed grave challenges to Indiana's fiscal integrity. But because we were willing to make the difficult changes, because we were willing to do what tough times demand, I can report tonight that Indiana's financial future is much, much more secure. to balance the budget and eliminate what threatened to be an enormous deficit, I ordered the largest spending cuts in Indiana history, $685 million. We increased our highest priority, education. But every other part of state government tightened its belt. And for the first time in more than 20 years, per-patient Medicaid costs have gone down. The result of this strong fiscal discipline will be a balanced budget at the end of the biennium without deficit spending. And a balanced budget with no deficit means that taxes will not increase.
I was tempted to run Mitch Daniels right after that in a recent State of the State address, but instead I want to move to him because I was intrigued by an interview that I was able to do with him last year, and then a subsequent interview on our network just a couple of months ago. It's a subject that you hear some about here, but on a national basis, this will continue until we get through 2012, I suspect. Let's watch.
Whatever your outlook on politics, here's some good news. This is the last time you'll have to watch me in an ad like this. See, governor's the only office I've run for or ever will. I have no ambition except the one we started with, to tackle Indiana's problems head on and leave a better place to our kids and theirs. We'd like to devote four more years of hard work to strengthening education, putting a permanent lid on property taxes, recruiting new jobs, and making college affordable for all. Rehire us, and we will.
Why did you say what you said in that ad about never running ever again for any office?
I suppose I said it because I wanted people to know that we're not on the make for anything else, that we really sincerely want a chance to improve our state, and that we'd give every bit of effort to that, and maybe to reassure people they wouldn't have to, you know, deal with us anymore after then.
Are you still of the same mind, no matter how often people are writing these days, oh, we think we're going to get him back in the 2012 race for president?
I am, for many reasons, but yes, I am.
Not going to go back on it under any circumstances.
I've painted myself in about as well, I think, as a person can.
You've been mentioned as somebody who might be among the Republican candidates for president. Where do you see yourself? Do you see yourself in that Republican presidential field in 2012?
You know, Eamon, I told one of your colleagues, there has never been a president of the United States in my bathroom mirror. And there wasn't this morning either. But there are other ways to try to have some impact on those things other than running oneself. And I don't think I'll have a different answer, but ask me in a year.
So you're leaving a little bit of wiggle room there. Don't expect to run is not the same as I will not run.
I gave an answer like that a month ago, and somebody back here interviewing my wife said, well, it sounded like Mitch cracked the door a little bit. And and Sherry said, when he gets home tonight, the door may not be cracked.
I'm delighted that I have the interview that I did with him for future possibilities, because I think he denied that he'd ever run four times in there. But, you know, people like us do those kind of things, and all he really has to say is, I've changed my mind, if he does, and off he goes. We only have two more. The next one is just fun for me to do. A friend of mine who is based in New York City, of New York City, born in New York City, thinks the whole world revolves around New York City, works at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, is the foremost Lincoln expert in this country, Harold Holzer. I was in Fort Wayne when the Lincoln Museum was there a couple years ago, and I interviewed him, and this is just 22 seconds of a moment. What's the expression on his face when I ask him where we are?
Explain, somebody that's never been to Fort Wayne, Indiana, kind of where it is and where this museum is inside Fort Wayne, and can you come here every day?
Where is Fort Wayne? Fort Wayne is in Indiana. Brian, you're in Indiana, and you have to tell me where Fort Wayne is. I fly to Detroit and then take a plane from Detroit to Fort Wayne, so you can help me with that.
Northeast.
Okay.
Harold's a typical flyover guy, you know. There's no idea that we exist out here. I'm not going to run the next one with Gwen Ifill. Unfortunately, she's not going to be able to join you because of a death in the family. But I told Lloyd Wright at least I'd say go PBS in Indianapolis. he's done a great job here, and we've had a chance to get to know each other over the years with Channel 20. Last, and this is the most exciting thing that we do, is a little video from our student camp contest. And this young fella is based in Bloomington. He was one of our third place winners. You'll see when you hear him talk, very sharp. And he leads us basically back to the media business that I'm involved in. This is about a minute 30. And this is a fella just won our third place in our student camp contest, Matt Helm.
And how do you think cable news has changed over the past couple of years?
I think it's gone from more of just a, I think it started off with just trying to relay news to people and tell people what was going on. But now I think it's gotten into more of a, maybe a competition for ratings and more towards entertainment, just trying to entertain people, get them to tune in, get them to watch so they can make more money.
Do you think that America has benefited from having more news outlets?
I think it's kind of, that's probably one of the main factors on why the news, cable news has contributed to incivility, because with so many news channels, you get more and more competition, and they feel they have a bigger need to get more viewers so they can compete with their rival news, cable news channels, which gives them more incentive to yell, scream, and do things that get people to tune in.
And now let's watch a portion of Matt's video.
The decline of civil discourse has become an obstacle in the pursuit of knowledge through news. According to AmericanProgress.org, mass media informs our political decisions. Media bias is not simply a problem of partisanship. It is a problem of peace or war, of solving our problems or descending into confusion. Has incivility become the driving force behind our television journalism today?
And you can watch Matt's entire video and all the other winning entries at studentcam.org.
For the life of me, I didn't think that well when I was a senior in high school. It's just amazing. And Jim and I were talking because he's all involved in charter school. There's no doubt, I mean, as crazy as the world is right now, that the young people of this country will make it right one way or the other. And having gone through these contests for the last several years, we had 1,000 entries this year. And we just had the grand prize winner with three young ladies, I think they're freshmen or eighth graders in Milwaukee, talking about nuclear power. It's a mind blower. That's the end of the great Hoosier Sound and Light Show.
Thank you, Brian. Now we have some questions from our audience, and
I do not trust this process.
This is well, I haven't gotten any from George Sweet or Jim Poole yet. But,
yeah, but they're back there.
Yeah. Should any aspect of government be off limits to C-SPAN cameras?
Yes, I think that private meetings that are held in people's offices, and the President of the United States has a right to meet with anybody he wants to. Our whole effort is just based on public meetings. That's where we think we belong. And you'd be surprised how hard it is sometimes to get in public meetings.
Why didn't you cover the healthcare debate on C-SPAN?
Well, we really did cover the healthcare debate on C-SPAN. What we didn't cover were the negotiations. It's a long story, and I think everybody knows that when you're negotiating, it's very difficult to have cameras in the room. It wasn't our idea. It was the president's. During his campaign, he told people time and time again, it's on video, that if elected, I'm going to negotiate all the health care legislation in front of C-SPAN cameras. And that's how all that controversy started. We always ask, every time we can, public officials to let our cameras in for public meetings. And what happens in the Capitol, the Senate and the House pass these bills, and then they come to a conference. And when a party is, I mean, both the houses are in the same party, then funny things begin to happen. They look over rules, both parties do this, that they normally want to live by. When there is one House Democrat, one House Republican, you always have a conference, unless everybody agrees. And all we did was send a letter to the Speaker and the Majority Leader and the Minority Leader and all that on both parties and say, if you are going to have a conference, we'd like to cover it. Normally, we're in all those conferences. But in the last couple years, Ted Stevens was one of the worst when he was chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and there was a conference, and he controlled it. He wouldn't let our cameras in. But in the last couple of years, funny stuff has been going on when it comes to the rules, and both parties have been doing the same thing, and all we can do is ask. And with all the different kinds of media today, what happens is that they all take a position very quickly, which I think, frankly, is very healthy.
Speaking of different media, can social media such as Facebook and Twitter, do they offer opportunities for C-SPAN?
Well, we have I call him the Tweetmeister, a man who's in charge of Twitter and Facebook and all that. You know, this is hard to believe, but Twitter and Facebook and iPhone and YouTube have only been around for 4 years. I mean, it is absolutely mind-boggling when you think about it. We have an application or an app on iPhone. You can listen to all three of our channels just by punching a button anywhere you are. It is the most fantastic thing. Yesterday we were traveling, and my wife Vicki has an iPhone. I don't, but I got to get one because I missed that whole darn thing yesterday, or should I say damn. I missed that whole thing, but we are available online. We've streamed all of our video live longer than anybody in the country in television, and we have the app on iPhone, as I said. We have HD radio in Washington. We're on XM channel 132. We're on as many applications as we can find so that if you're interested, and everybody's not interested in this stuff, but if you're interested, you can have at it.
It is said that bipartisanship ended in Washington with Congress and the Senate frequently, congressmen and senators frequently going home to their districts instead of building interparty relationships. Would you please comment?
I'm not one that worries a whole lot about this civility thing. I think we're probably better off when people are at each other's throat, challenging each other, questioning how bills are made. The tough thing, and I'm not the only, I mean, your senator, Evan Bayh, probably spoke it louder than anybody. It's an unhappy town right now, but it's unhappy for one simple reason. We're out of money. And when you're out of money and you can't figure out what to do with it all, then everybody's at each other's throats because they still want the money. That's changed dramatically since I've been in Washington. There's a lot more money and a lot more lobbyists and a lot more of everything. And so, consequently, people aren't very happy. I don't know how this all works out in the end, but the stronger the different voices are, the better chance we as citizens have of figuring out what's going on. Because I know when I first got to town in 1966, there was an awful lot that you never knew because it was all done, everything was done out of camera range or out of microphone range or out of even the print press range. So it's healthy. I know. Here's the difference. When we were growing up, I say we, not for everybody in this room, but people my age were growing up, we had three choices on the dial, ABC, NBC, and CBS, and there was an educational station and maybe an independent like Channel 4 down here, and that was it. And you took what they gave you. Now the burden's on us. There's more information. There are more opportunities to learn. There are more websites, more everything than you can imagine. I mean, there's no way. Jim and I were talking there. I probably haven't been able to watch 5% of what C-SPAN has done over the last 31 years. There's no time, but it's there for somebody at whatever moment they want to watch it. And now with the website, you can call it up and watch it on your own time because it's all there. So the burden's on us from now on. Can't complain. If you don't like Fox, you don't like MSNBC, just turn it off. The worst thing you do is sit there and watch it and start to slit your wrist because you can't stand it. I mean, think about it. Just think about that for a minute. You're saying, honey, this is awful. Can you believe what they're saying? And honey looks at you like you're nuts anyway and says, why are you watching it? And goes off and reads a book. Right, honey? But it's, you know, at any given time, on any network, on cable, unless it's a major national event, there are only The highest rated show, Bill O'Reilly, is 3.5 million. If you haven't looked lately, there are 309 million people in the United States. He has enough audience to make his 25 million a year, whatever it is, but it's not a very big audience. And there are vast numbers of people that never go there. And I think that's healthy. Not that they never go there, but they have all that choice.
You may have already answered this question in part, but perhaps there's something you'd like to add. What are the best and worst changes in government and politics in general since you started C-SPAN?
This is an old saw for me, and I've been saying this for years. There's too much money in it. It's nothing new. Mitch Daniels gave one heck of a speech a couple of years ago, or maybe it was last year at Butler University, where he talked about that. When I started in this business, money was never an object. Rush Limbaugh signed a contract for 8 years for $400 million. I said O'Reilly is probably 25. I don't know for sure. Sean Hannity's 25 million. Oprah Winfrey, 1.5 billion. I don't begrudge them for making all that money, but that changed the game. Sig Mickelson, who used to run CBS News, who's deceased, and in an interview I did with him 25 years ago probably, put his finger on the moment when money became the issue in news. It's when he was walking down the street in New York City in 1952, and he said to Walter Cronkite, get an agent. And Walter Cronkite got an agent. And that's when it all changed, because it all now is about money. People don't go in the business like they used to because they love the information world. They go in because they know they can make a tremendous amount of money. Same thing is true in politics. You come to Washington, you spend, I don't know, 20 years there, you never go home. You put your shingle out downtown, you become a lobbyist, you quadruple the amount of money you were making in Congress or far beyond that. You leave Congress now in midstream to run trade associations because they're going to pay you $2 million. That's what's changed. I don't like it. A lot of other people don't like it, but it may be there forever, and as long as it's there, we have to deal with it, understand it, and then confront people who we elect with this issue if it matters to you.
Final question. You are known as an avid reader. What have you been reading lately that you would recommend to us?
I don't know that I'd recommend. I try not to recommend books. I'm currently reading a book by Nouriel Roubini on markets. I don't know anything about markets. I don't invest in the market. I just am fascinated and wonder how long it's going to be before we go down. So I keep reading about this stuff, trying to figure it out. I don't read as much as I used to in books. I used to read a book a week. As a C student from Purdue, who barely made it through that place, Jim Poole and George Sweet, we were all together, lived together. They pulled me through somehow because it was very close at the end. You know, there are just so many good history books are the most fabulous thing. I love it. I have met and got to be friends with a lot of historians, and nothing is more exciting than have somebody call you. I'll just give you an example. Yesterday, Richard Norton Smith, who's a terrific presidential historian, we were chatting, and he does some work for us, and he said, have you seen the new book on Henry Clay? And I had it on my desk there, and I hadn't paid any attention. He said, oh, it's just fabulous. It's just terrific. And he goes on a riff about Henry Clay. Now, when was the last time anybody in this room sat around talking about Henry Clay? Maura Pierce, who's here, used to work with us at C-SPAN, is a terrific historian. And I'm sure immediately when I say this, she'll be out there buying the book on Henry Clay. Because there are people, and when you get access to people who know a lot more about it than you do, it is the most stimulating thing. If David McCullough stands up in front of a group like this and says, read this one book on history, probably a quarter of the people in this room would go find the book. So I'm always listening to suggestions from these historians, and as often as I can, I want to get them on C-SPAN so that you can hear them and get the same excitement that I do. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
That was C-SPAN founder Brian Lamb. Lamb has also hosted the program Book Notes since the program's inception in 1989, taping more than 600 nonfiction author interviews. He's published three books based on that series. And now, Secretary of Commerce and Indiana Economic Development Corporation CEO Mitch Robe talks about Indiana's future economic opportunities and what keeps and brings business to Indiana. Robe also talks about Indiana's opportunities in foreign investments for the state.
My job at the Indiana Economic Development Corporation is really to be the chief salesman for the state of Indiana, both inside Indiana, throughout this country, and increasingly across the globe. We spend a great deal of time and effort attracting foreign direct investment here to Indiana. Indiana has, since its founding, been the home of a great deal of European investment. And in the last 30 years, we've gotten a fair amount of Japanese investment, second only to the state of California. Indiana has the most Japanese investment in the country. Over 45,000 Hoosiers went to work this morning in Japanese-owned companies. And increasingly, we're spending time in China. China and probably India will be next. We are investing here in this country, and obviously we want them to invest in Indiana. Keeping business here is if you're open, you want to be working here in Indiana. We did a tremendous job last year in Indiana in terms of competitive consolidation, where companies looked at what you'd call the new normal and said, I want to keep my operations in Indiana and expand them and close in Michigan and Ohio and Wisconsin, California, et cetera. So keeping the business that we have from moving out of state is not really that difficult because of the sandbox the governor's built with the help of the legislature. We've got terrific infrastructure. We're a low-cost state. A whole bunch of reasons that Indiana is very competitive in the Midwest. In terms of attracting people here to Indiana, what we primarily focus on, again, is our sandbox, the fact that we are a low-cost state. We have terrific infrastructure. We've got a very well-educated, hard-working workforce. Some people talk about us as having all the benefits of the Midwest, the work ethic, and all the benefits of the South, the cost structure. So we're a very comfortable place for businesses to locate and to invest. We will, on occasion, incentivize companies to locate here to either expand or to locate here in the first place. We do that primarily using a program called the EDGE program, and what that does is rebates to the company a percentage of the income tax their employees pay. So if you work for the XYZ company, we'll rebate a small percentage of your income tax to that company for a period of years to attract that firm. But in terms of overt cash grants to companies, we very rarely do we end up doing that. We have done one loan in the last 5 years to a company, so we don't do very many loans either. Last year, we attracted 19,950 jobs. About 5,000 of them paid more than $50,000 a year. Every one of those 5,000 jobs required a high degree of math skills. So if you wanted to make more than $50,000 a year, you need to be able to do math effectively. To work in science, to work in the pharmaceutical industry, to make cars, you need to understand how to do statistics, how to do algebra, in many cases, how to do calculus. If you don't have that skill set, your choices are not going to be very great in this state, in this country, or in the world economy. The jobs that we see that require math are really across the spectrum, from advanced manufacturing to the life sciences to the, quote, green energy, close quote, jobs. Every single job that we attracted that paid more than $50,000 a year required a high degree of math skills. The reason that we today in America drive a much higher quality vehicle than when I was a boy is because of math, that that quality is engineered in throughout the process, including the production process. So if you talk to the folks at Honda, at Subaru, at Toyota, who produce high-quality cars in this state, their workforce needs to be able to do statistical process control to create the kind of product that the world market demands. And we have a major program, and it's a pretty effective program because it's a refundable tax credit. The EDGE program is a refundable tax credit. Beyond that, most of our programs are very small. We do have a 21st Century Fund program that helps helps startup companies that we provide matching funds to on occasion after a due diligence process. But primarily, Indiana does not invest in private companies, right? What we've chosen to do is invest our dollars and efforts in the Daniels administration in creating a business environment that companies wish to thrive in. In terms of the recession being over, it's hard for me to say that the recession is over when the national unemployment rate is at 9.7%. That just doesn't work for me. So there are an awful lot of unemployed people in this country, a lot of people who for whom the recession isn't over. So I don't buy that the recession is over. We have seen an uptick in the investments that companies are willing to make this year, but that's off of a very low base. I mean, last year we had less than $2 billion worth of private investment. The previous year we had over $4 billion worth of private investment for about the same number of jobs. This year we're back on track to probably do in the $4 to $5 billion range of private investment, but that will make it an okay year. Over time, that investment will pay off in jobs that are secure, that are unlikely to leave, and that's important. So we like to see that investment. That's the best news we have for you. We haven't seen the deals we have as many deals in the pipeline today as we did 6 months ago, but not more. All right. Clearly, it's better than it was a year ago. Mm-hmm. All right, but is it back to a robust 2006 level? Nope.
That was Secretary of Commerce Mitch Robe talking about Indiana's economic opportunities. Next month on the Economic Club of Indiana, the president and CEO of the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership, Mark Miles, will speak to the members. Miles led the bid team which secured the 2012 NFL Super Bowl for Indianapolis, and he's the chairman of the Super Bowl Host Committee. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. I'm Mary Hartnett. Thanks for listening.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.